Chapter 32. For 6 decades and counting, the accounts offered about what happened on the fateful day prior to Marilyn Monroe's death by her housekeeper Eunice Murray, by her friend-slash-publicist Pat Newcomb, and celebrity Peter Lawford have all been questioned. Aside from Newcomb and Murray, there have been suspicions that the last person to see or hear from Marilyn may have been Robert F. Kennedy and whomever may have joined him at her new home. While the accounts differ as to the exact time and duration of the potential visit, if true, RFK could have had a confrontational conversation with Marilyn regarding her going to the media and telling secrets threatening him and his family. Concerning these suspicions, many have been dismissed since Bobby had what appeared to be an airtight alibi, one which placed him in the San Francisco Bay Area at the time Marilyn died. According to an Associated Press story, Robert Kennedy, wife Ethel, and 4 of their children arrived at the San Francisco airport on Friday afternoon, August 3rd. In order to enjoy a quiet vacation, the Kennedys then traveled 60 miles south to the South Valley Ranch owned by John Bates, a close friend of President Kennedy and brother Robert. The ranch was located on Redwood Retreat Road in the rural region between Morgan Hill and Gilroy, California, southeast of Santa Cruz. Kennedy had apparently come to California to give the opening speech at an American Bar Association conference in San Francisco that Monday. Attempts to confirm this account have proven unsuccessful. According to statements by Bates, his family members, and employed staff during a 1985 interview with the New York Times, Robert spent all his time relaxing with his family at the ranch from Friday afternoon to Monday morning that October 1962 weekend. The Kennedys went on a Saturday morning horseback ride into the hills, followed by a noontime pool swim and barbecue. In the afternoon, Robert organized a touch football game. On Sunday, the Kennedys attended the 9:30 a.m. Mass at St. Mary's Church in Gilroy. Bates, in his interview, added, "The Attorney General and his family were with us every minute from Friday afternoon to Monday, and there is simply no physical way that he could have gone to Southern California and returned." One contrary account, among many, but arguably the most credible since its accuracy has not been questioned through the years, is corroborated by a 20th Century Fox Studios security log that listed visitors to the Los Angeles location on Pico Boulevard in West Los Angeles. Before 11 a.m. on August 4, 1962, a helicopter landed at the 20th Century Fox Studios helipad near Stage 14. Studio publicist Frank Neal, working that Saturday morning, said he saw Robert Kennedy jump out of the helicopter and rush to a dark gray limousine waiting nearby. Neal said he got a glimpse of movie star Peter Lawford, brother-in-law to the Kennedys, sitting inside. Research indicates that helicopter travel in 1962 was quite limited distance-wise, and therefore a trip by helicopter from San Francisco to Los Angeles may not have been possible. However, a helicopter ride from an airfield located in the Gilroy area to perhaps Santa Barbara may have occurred, whereupon another helicopter ride from that city to the Fox lot in L.A. would have deposited Bobby minutes from Marilyn's home. Additional documented accounts, including one attributed to former Los Angeles Mayor Sam Yorty, relating what former Police Chief William Parker told him, place RFK and Lawford at the Beverly Hilton Hotel that afternoon, although there are some accounts landing them at the nearby Beverly Hills Hotel. Either way, RFK being in Los Angeles appears to be substantiated by Beverly Hills police officer Lynn Franklin, the most decorated officer in the history of that department at the time. Through the years, his account has been disputed, but its accuracy should be evaluated in light of other evidence to follow. Franklin swore in his book, The Beverly Hills Murder File, that at 12:10 a.m. on August 5, 1962, just as events were unfolding at Marilyn's home following her death, I stopped a Lincoln Continental sedan going east on Olympic Boulevard at Robertson at about 70 miles an hour, 35 over the speed limit. Peter Lawford, the actor, and Kennedy in-law was driving. I knew Lawford. Author's note, Olympic Boulevard is an east-west Los Angeles street and crosses Robertson Boulevard, which stretches through West Hollywood and Beverly Hills. Officer Franklin then recalled that he asked Lawford, "Pete, what the hell do you think you're doing?" And Lawford replied, "I'm trying to get the Attorney General to the hotel to pick up his luggage and then get him to the airport." At that point, Franklin said he shined his flashlight toward the back seat, and sitting there was Robert Kennedy, who didn't look happy. The conversation between Franklin and Lawford then continued, with the former explaining to the actor that he was going in the wrong direction if he wanted to locate the Beverly Hilton where RFK was supposedly staying. Upon hearing of the mistake, Franklin swore that Bobby said, "I told you, stupid," whereupon Franklin decided not to issue Lawford a speeding ticket while also failing to ask him who the person sitting beside him was. Summing up the encounter, Franklin later stated, "From photographs, I recognized the third man. It was Dr. Ralph Greenson, the psychiatrist who treated Marilyn Monroe at that time." Placing Greenson with Lawford and RFK may seem a stretch, but with the confusing nature of what happened before, during, and after Marilyn died, it certainly could have been possible, and there appears to be no viable reason why Franklin had reason to lie. Besides Franklin, Darrell Gates, later to become Los Angeles police chief, swore Robert Kennedy was in the city at the time Marilyn died. In his autobiography, Chief, My Life in the LAPD, Gates wrote, "I was working out of Chief Parker's office when Monroe died, and like the rest of the world, we were shocked. It is my own opinion that her death was accidental," while then adding, "The truth is, we knew Robert Kennedy was in town, Los Angeles, on August 4th. By way of proof, Gates said, "We always knew when he was here. He was the Attorney General, so we were interested in him, the same way we were interested when other important figures came to Los Angeles. But while we knew Robert Kennedy was in town that day, we paid no attention to where he went or what he did, whether he saw Monroe or not." RFK being seen either at the Beverly Hilton or the Beverly Hills Hotel, where Papa Joe had often stayed in previous years, was no surprise. In his book, The Strange Death of Marilyn Monroe, Frank Capel chronicled Bobby's appearances in L.A. at the Beverly Hills Hotel in July 1962, the month before Marilyn died. By having somehow secured a copy of the hotel's ledger, Capel provided details regarding one of two visits, with there being a room charge, a local phone charge, a restaurant charge, a long-distance phone charge, and another local phone charge. Capel's proof of RFK staying at the Beverly Hills Hotel from time to time doesn't correspond with Lawford's statement that he was headed for the Beverly Hilton on the day in question, but because of the proximity of the two hotels, just 6 minutes of driving time between them, Lawford may have either been lying or mistaken. Unfortunately, this author's attempts to secure guest records from the Beverly Hilton on the 4th or 5th of August 1962 have not been fruitful. Another interesting aspect of the question of RFK having been in Los Angeles on the day Marilyn died comes from her housekeeper, Eunice Murray. If one views the 1985 BBC documentary Say Goodbye to the President, Eunice appears 13 years after Marilyn died. Apparently, following her interview, she stated, "Why at my age do I have to cover up this thing?" When asked to clarify, she added, "I was not supposed to know the Kennedys were a very important part of Marilyn's life, but over a period of time, I was a witness to what was happening." Asked then about whether RFK was at Marilyn's home on the day she died, Murray reportedly said, "Oh, sure, yes. I was in the living room when he arrived. She was not dressed," without elaborating on what the latter comment meant. Of interest at the time would have been information provided by Janet Peters, whose father, Marlowe Carlyle Hodge, was the realtor who listed Marilyn's home once she died. In an interview with this author in September 2020, Peters said, "My dad came home one day and told me, 'I just sold Marilyn Monroe's house. Had the opportunity to speak with Eunice Murray, her housekeeper at the house. She was very affable, we had a long talk, and she was adamant that Marilyn was murdered, said it was the Kennedys, Bobby Kennedy, not a suicide at all.'" Peters's recollections, while being second-hand, appeared genuine if one believes what Murray told the BBC. Together, the two statements certainly provide food for thought as to RFK's complicity in Marilyn's death. On page 57 of this book, Capel detailed the Attorney General's trips to Hollywood to see Jerry Wald, the producer who was going to make a film out of Bobby's book, The Enemy Within. Capel, ever vigilant with his investigation, noted that when in Beverly Hills, Bobby Kennedy stayed at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and one of his visits is an interesting one. On July 26th and July 27th, 1962, as noted in the hotel ledger, he stayed in room number 227 and had the charges for room, meals, and telephone calls billed to the National Insurance Association in Chicago. While there is no ledger for August 4, 1962 available, Capel's research does prove this is where RFK sometimes stayed during his Los Angeles visits. The author then revealed that one party Marilyn attended at the Lawfords, at which the Attorney General was present, was of sufficient interest to her to have spent $70 for a special hairdo and makeup, nearly $600 in today's currency. Capel also noted that the Lawfords were frequent party throwers and closely associated with Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack. Three matters of interest may be garnered from this document. First, apparently, Agnes M. Flanagan was Marilyn's hairdresser at the time. Second, whoever prepared this creditor's document requesting that the Superior Court order Ms. Flanagan to be paid a total of $280 for hairstyling from Marilyn's estate listed the date of death as August 5, 1962, not the previous day. Why this happened is unknown. Third, of special importance is that the charges for Marilyn's hairstyling for dinner party Peter Lawford's home is for Miss Flanagan's assistance on July 26th, 10 days before Marilyn died. This date coincides with Bobby having been in Beverly Hills during that time, as proved through the Beverly Hills Hotel ledger. In addition, the ledger proves RFK also stayed at the hotel on the 27th of July. This would have permitted him 2 days within which to have spent time with Marilyn. Capel also revealed that the two had obviously communicated before that, since there were a number of phone calls made as shown by Marilyn's telephone records to Robert Kennedy. The calls were made both to the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C., and to the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco. Providing credibility for Capel's research is the FBI memo previously mentioned. It stated that informants advised Marilyn Monroe attended a luncheon at the residence of Peter Lawford with President Kennedy. It is dated 7/26/62. Mystifying during this time is a June 13, 1962 telegram Marilyn sent to McLean, Virginia, Attorney General and Mrs. Robert Kennedy, which is designated as M. Monroe, personal message, at the bottom of the ledger Capel secured from her accountant, Arthur P. Jacobs, Inc., when they sent Marilyn an accounting on July 31, 1962, 5 days before she died. The substance of the telegram and why Marilyn would have sent it to both of them is unknown, but if Ethel became aware of the telegram, it may have caused her to question Bobby about his relationship with the movie star. While Capel's reputation was batted about by those associated with the Kennedy family and others through the years who were skeptical of his investigative capabilities, a letter he included in his book appears to confirm his acumen for pursuing the truth. Muddying the waters regarding RFK's alibi on the 4th of August is the fact that John Bates served as an attorney for mobster Sam Giancana, RFK's mortal enemy, during the same McClellan hearings where RFK served as chief counsel. That Bates covered up the truth as to Bobby's whereabouts on the day Marilyn died would have certainly crossed the mind of Dorothy Kilgallen. More alarming, however, is the primary source evidence, including Daryl Gates's credible accounts, showing that RFK lied about his whereabouts at the time Marilyn died. But, as Fred Krause, whose family knew the Kennedys very well in the Boston area before, during, and after JFK became president, told this author in March 2020, they thought they were nobility. Irish royalty, my mother used to say. They'd even go into a restaurant in Cape Cod, eat, and then walk out without paying their bill. People around where we lived hated the Kennedys, called them the limousine liberals, said they were all womanizers. Regarding Joe Kennedy, Krause said, "It was all about money and power," before adding, "People called his sons the Kennedy boys. No one had any use for them." Based on the reputation of the Kennedy boys, is it any wonder Bobby said he was in San Francisco instead of L.A. when Marilyn died? No surprise at all for a member of a family who thought they were Irish royalty to the extent of not even paying a restaurant bill despite their wealth. Whether Bobby believed this or not, two photographs never published together before and obtained by this author from former South Carolina sheriff's deputy, investigator, and noted forensics expert Troy Vaughn add a strange twist to the saga of the attorney general's whereabouts on the day Marilyn died. The first photo is a bit fuzzy, but not enough to prevent Bobby from being recognized wearing Bermuda shorts and apparently standing next to his family, including Ethel, at the Bates Ranch in Gilroy. Notice the automobile with the driver's side door open and the wood paneling beneath the window. The second photo depicts two men, perhaps from the mortuary, wheeling Marilyn's covered body not out of, for whatever reason, but into her home on the day she died. Notice in the background the automobile, which appears to be a duplicate of the car RFK and his family were standing by at the Bates Ranch. Certainly, this could be a coincidence, but one must wonder whether somehow that car was driven from Gilroy to Los Angeles and then appeared at Marilyn's death scene. By whom will never be known. Regardless of whether RFK was in Los Angeles during the hours before Marilyn died, what really matters concerns whether the two famous personalities had a confrontation about Bobby dumping her just as JFK had done. The possibility the Attorney General set up Marilyn for the kill, a likely scenario based on the need to silence her, doesn't depend on his having been in L.A. at all. If he was truly in the San Francisco area, arguably the second most powerful man in America could have orchestrated her death with a phone call from afar. In her autobiography, My Story, written in 1954, 8 years before she died, and published in 1974, Marilyn Monroe wrote about the Hollywood wolves who pursued her. The writing talents mirror those of Kilgallen, a compliment for certain. I met them all. Phoniness and failure were all over them. Some were vicious and crooked, but they were as near to the movies as you could get, so you sat with them, listening to their lies and schemes, and you saw Hollywood with their eyes, an overcrowded brothel, a merry-go-round with beds for horses. Based on the final sentence, one may only imagine the cesspool of lies Marilyn waded into while attempting to become the bona fide actress she dreamed of being, with the wolves always circling, always with one thing on their minds: getting her on the merry-go-round, where there were beds to consume her body instead of the hobby horses and calliope music meant for children who could laugh and play. As she further describes in My Story, from the moment Marilyn hit the Hollywood scene and into the 1960s, she had to battle powerful men like Bobby Kennedy, who promised to love her or make her a star, and then disappeared after they used her for their own purposes. Men like the Kennedys then, and men like Harvey Weinstein and others today, are being exposed for their evil ways during the modern Me Too era. Marilyn had described more disgusting behavior in a January 1953 article entitled Wolves I Have Known in Motion Picture and Television Magazine. The accounts parallel those in My Story. In My Story, Marilyn added another insight into her mindset at the time. Yes, there was something special about me, and I knew what it was. I was the kind of girl they found dead in a hall bedroom with an empty bottle of sleeping pills in her hand. This followed a sad note regarding how lonely she felt at times. I knew I belonged to the public and to the world, not because I was talented or even beautiful, but because I had never belonged to anything or anyone else. Marilyn's premonition about how she might die stands out as uncanny and poignant. Theories regarding the reason for her death, some more credible than others, include answers such as the following to the question, why was Marilyn killed? Recapping the alternatives, 1. Marilyn threatened to expose classified information about UFOs provided to her by JFK. Recall that the 1962 CIA document exists featuring the contents of a wiretapped conversation between Marilyn and Kilgallen 2 days before Monroe's death. During the call, Marilyn tells Kilgallen that JFK had told Marilyn of his visit to a secret airbase where he viewed things from outer space. This admission allegedly involved the 1947 Roswell, New Mexico crash of what the government officials swore was an Army Air Force balloon. Later, it was alleged that, in fact, an alien spacecraft had crash-landed, permitting a group of extraterrestrials to infiltrate the area, with the government covering up the incident. During a press briefing that was supposed to be off the record, JFK was supposedly asked what he thought about UFOs. If this happened, and, as noted, some doubt its accuracy, the president was quoted as saying, "I would like to tell the public about the UFO situation, but my hands are tied." As mentioned, some theories have circulated that the president had been assassinated by those who feared his disclosure of further information about the UFO phenomenon. In fact, he had requested, according to a letter released by the CIA, more information on UFOs on November 12, 1963, within days of his assassination. The subject line read, "Classification Review of All UFO Intelligence Affecting National Security." Based on the wiretapped conversation between Rothberg and Kilgallen, the possibility exists that Marilyn might have revealed the secrets JFK told her about UFOs. Those in power could not let that happen. 1. Marilyn was killed since she was going to expose, as noted in the Rothberg report, the president's plan to kill Castro. 2. Marilyn was killed since she threatened to expose her romantic relationship with President Kennedy. 3. Marilyn was a threat to national security secrets JFK shared with her and the possibility that she would leak them to the wrong people and thus had to be eliminated. 4. Marilyn threatened to expose her romantic relationship with Robert Kennedy and any inside information he may have shared with her about national security matters, marking her for death. 5. Marilyn was killed since she threatened to call a news conference and expose notebooks and her diary of secrets mentioned in the Rothberg report and/or audio tapes she had kept during trysts with both John and Robert Kennedy. 6. Through whatever Frank Sinatra shared with her or what she learned from either JFK or RFK about the inside story as to how Joe Kennedy fixed the 1960 presidential election, Marilyn's death was set up at the behest of Patriarch Joe to appear as a suicide when she, in fact, was murdered. 7. For any of the previous reasons, Marilyn was killed by Joseph Kennedy's operatives since she was a definite threat, a loose cannon in their view, to bring down Joe's dream of a dynasty where Robert and Ted Kennedy became president following JFK's 8-year term. 8. Underworld figures such as Sam Giancana and Carlos Marcello orchestrated Marilyn's death through operatives since they wanted to send a message to Bobby Kennedy that if she could be silenced, they could certainly eliminate RFK as well, and therefore he had better stop hounding them. While killing Marilyn, the operatives were instructed to confiscate Marilyn's notebooks, diary, and audio tapes. 9. Rogue government agents aligned with J. Edgar Hoover, the same rogue agents who confiscated Kilgallen's documents and files when they raided her townhouse on the day she was killed, were ordered to silence Marilyn and steal any documents she had that could bring down Hoover. Pursuit of answers relating to these possibilities ended for good, at least until now, when, in 1993, a Los Angeles grand jury, approved and ready to be convened to investigate Marilyn's death, was stopped in its tracks. The reasons remain fuzzy to this day, but from this list of suspects is one who stands out above all others, the one who is a perfect fit based on motive, means, opportunity, and especially benefit from the crime. As Dorothy Kilgallen continued to be deeply affected by Marilyn's death, she discovered the bombshell actress had been speaking with someone from D.C. right before she died. Having been provided details of Marilyn and Robert Kennedy's love affair by a photographer friend of Marilyn's, Kilgallen believed it was RFK who called her or that Marilyn had called him. In October 2017, the FBI memo dated 7-7-64, nearly 2 years after Marilyn died and previously mentioned, was released with additional JFK assassination files by the U.S. government. It appears to confirm what Kilgallen knew through her sources, that RFK had picked up where JFK left off after he dumped the famous movie star. The collection of documents specifies that they are part of what it called Miscellaneous Records of the Church Committee, named after Idaho Democratic Senator Frank Church. It convened in 1975 as a U.S. Senate Select Committee to investigate abuses by the Central Intelligence Agency, National Security Agency, Federal Bureau of Investigation, and Internal Revenue Service. Why Marilyn would have been of interest to the committee 13 years after she died regarding the alleged abuses is unknown, but the subject of the collection is titled Monroe, Marilyn, and Robert Kennedy under JFK Assassination System Identification Form Record Number 157-10014-10205. If this committee was reviewing abuses regarding the assassination, why was Marilyn connected to that review? Based on a United States Department of Justice memo dated April 2, 1976, it appears the committee had requested all FBI material pertaining to communications between FBI Director Hoover and Attorney General Robert Kennedy with respect to the publication of a book about Marilyn by Frank Capel. Regarding the request, whomever prepared the memo wrote, "Enclosed is material responsive to your request." While page 3 of the report, which is entitled Monroe, Marilyn, is completely redacted, page 5 is a copy of a July 15, 1964 memo to the Attorney General from Director FBI Hoover with the subject matter Frank A. Capel, Information Concerning Internal Security. This page indicates that Robert Kennedy was made aware of the Capel book, even to the point of letting him know the page numbers 49 through 61, 69, and 70, where Capel claims that you had a close relationship with Miss Monroe. By this time, she had been dead close to 2 years. Also of note is the final sentence before enclosure, which reads, "A copy of this book is enclosed, proving Bobby was given the opportunity to read the book. It contained, as will be shown, very damaging evidence about not only his close relationship with Marilyn, but a possible role in her death. Beside the word personal, the memo suggests it was circulated to several FBI agents, including Mr. DeLoach, known as Deke. Deke was, at the time, Deputy Associate Director. Someone at the Bureau named R.W. Smith also sent a memo to Mr. W.C. Sullivan dated July 14, 1964. It read, Memo. Baumgartner to Sullivan. 7-7-64 stated New York office advised the new book by Frank A. Capel entitled The Strange Death of Marilyn Monroe, which alleges that Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy had an intimate relationship with Marilyn Monroe, would be ready for sale about 7-10-64. Kennedy's friendship with Miss Monroe, well known. The New York office has now furnished us with a copy of this 70-page book. The book claims that Miss Monroe's involvement with Kennedy was well known to her friends and reporters in the Hollywood area, but was never publicized. It is alleged that there are person-to-person telephone calls, living witnesses, tape recordings, and certain writings to attest the closeness of the friendship. Besides the plethora of evidence confirming the Marilyn RFK involvement, the memo suggests that Miss Monroe was led to believe RFK's intentions were serious, and that Kennedy had promised to divorce his wife and marry her. When he failed to do so, the book charges, she threatened to expose their relationship, which would have ruined his presidential aspirations. It was then that Kennedy decided to take drastic action. Once again, whomever read the Capel book, arguably Agent R.W. Smith, must have done so carefully, since the page numbers with allegations about RFK are included. He also wrote, It should be noted that the allegation concerning the Attorney General and Miss Monroe has been circulated in the past and has been branded as utterly false. Why Smith quoted the section of the book alleging that, under the direction of Bobby Kennedy, the FBI has been frustrated as never before, is unknown. But it seems plausible to believe that Smith, because of RFK's lack of cooperation regarding any investigation of the allegations against him, believed Bobby had frustrated the Bureau as never before. To understand the letter and memos in context, it should be recalled that by July 15, 1964, JFK had been dead for nearly 8 months, with Bobby just 2 months away from resigning as Attorney General in September of that year. Whether what might be called the alleged Marilyn affair surfacing in Capel's book was instrumental in any way toward the resignation is unknown, but certainly RFK's public image could have taken a gigantic hit. But apparently it did not, since RFK announced his candidacy for the U.S. Senate on August 24, 1964, leading to the belief that he was not concerned with the alleged Marilyn affair becoming a campaign issue. The book in question, as noted, was titled The Strange Death of Marilyn Monroe. It is a short book, just 79 pages in length, as confirmed by this author's purchase of a copy. The accurate page count is a departure from the FBI memo stating the book was 70 pages in length. In the introduction, Capel, who was roasted by so-called experts regarding his accounts due to his being an overzealous anti-communist, wrote, This is the story of an American girl who was used by materialist, avaricious people, by false friends with bad advice, by sex-depraved VIPs. She came under the influence of many whom she allowed, in childlike trust, to chart the course of her life and who led her to a premature grave. That she became immoral cannot be denied, but she was also kind and generous. Regarding specifics as to the sex-depraved VIPs, Capel wrote, Marilyn Monroe's involvement with a VIP during the period just preceding her death was well known to her friends and reporters in the Hollywood area. This important person was and is ambitious, ruthless, and will stop at nothing which is to become President of the United States. Capel, without question, points his finger at Robert Kennedy instead of JFK, since the latter was already president. RFK's family and friends and other so-called experts have denounced the account, but it's difficult to quarrel with Capel's description of the Attorney General as ambitious, ruthless. More important, what was the drastic action by RFK the author alluded to in his book? Again, logic appears to dictate that such action would involve harm to Marilyn, harm that could never be traced. In fact, in his book, dubbed by a Texas newspaper as "One That Will Shock You, Shame You, and Scare You," Capel wrote of how Marilyn died. Physicians questioned by the author knew of no case of acute barbiturate poisoning causing death by ingestion of overdose in which some residue of the drug was not found in the stomach or duodenum. Yet Dr. Noguchi could not find a single crystal of the drug during his microscopic examination. Apparently, Capel knew what he had written would have widespread repercussions and could place him in danger. He wrote, "As an old-time investigator of criminal and subversive activities, the author is well aware of the possibilities of retaliation, reprisal, and revenge, and has accordingly taken the necessary precautions of having several sets of documents and other evidence placed in the hands of a number of patriotic individuals, including newspapermen and members of Senate and House committees." Evaluating the validity of Capel's claims is possible by closely scrutinizing the details included in his book, which was published, it may be recalled, within 2 years of Marilyn's death. These details include the following regarding Marilyn and Joe DiMaggio. Like leeches, the left-wingers managed to cling to Marilyn through her years of success in Hollywood. Her marriage to Joe, while unsuccessful, was one which might have been happy if they had been left alone. Joe sincerely loved her and deeply mourned her passing. Joe had felt that something was wrong, that Marilyn was in danger, and had resigned his $100,000 per year job as vice president of VH Monet Inc. in Virginia to come to California to be near her. Joe DiCarlo emerges as one figure close to the events surrounding Marilyn's death who apparently believed Capel's research was accurate. Regarding his friend Dwight Manley's account, Joe was aware that Robert Kennedy was not in the San Francisco area on the date Monroe died, but in the Los Angeles area. According to an interview this author had in mid-May 2020 with DiCarlo's niece, Joanne Romanovich, and her husband David Lutz, DiCarlo, depicted by Manley as one of Mickey Cohen's enforcers, appeared to be obsessed with Capel's book and the information contained therein. What is the evidence proving this obsession? Romanovich and Lutz recalled that before DiCarlo died in February 2016, he gave them a copy of Capel's book and asked them to keep it for him, telling them, "It's all in there," meaning the truth about Marilyn's life and times and the events surrounding her death. Lutz even remembers DiCarlo blessing the book when he passed it on, adding that he wanted to safekeep it because, DiCarlo said, "There are not too many copies around. The Kennedys had tried to keep it off the market to the extent of even buying as many copies as possible, apparently to keep the public from reading them." When the couple retrieved their copy from their safe at this author's request, they realized two important matters of interest. First, there was only one paragraph circled in the entire book. It was on page 55. The page including the paragraph was situated in a section of the book entitled "The VIP." The first paragraph of that section, on page 49, read, "Although Marilyn Monroe lived in the glare of publicity, one of the fateful associations of her life was carefully shielded from that glare. Her friendship with Attorney General Robert Kennedy was well known to newspaper reporters and columnists in the Los Angeles and Hollywood area, but never publicized." Capel then added, "Many of the criticisms which were directed against the late President John F. Kennedy, and for which he took full responsibility, were actually recommendations and decisions made by his younger brother, Robert F. Kennedy. Over the next few pages, Capel listed several of those recommendations and decisions, including those the author said exposed Bobby Kennedy's mad ambition to become President of the United States and the boldness with which Bobby takes the law into his own hands. The paragraph DiCarlo circled on page 55 read as follows. The ruthlessness of this man, his utter disregard for the rights of others, in spite of his political pose as a champion of civil rights, is frightening. He does not hesitate to try to embarrass and even disgrace the President of the United States with the idea of promoting himself. He feels that he has evidence of alleged questionable financial transactions on the part of Mr. Johnson and is accordingly immune. While Capel's words spanking Bobby Kennedy for his various attitudes and considerable flaws are quite clear, what the author meant by the last line regarding Mr. Johnson, apparently referencing President Lyndon Johnson, was not explained. Most mysterious are the words, "is accordingly immune," with, again, no clarification. Certainly, the words ruthlessness and frightening speak for themselves regarding Capel's opinion of the Attorney General. Predictably, Capel's book, as noted, was trashed both when it was published and still today, with some authors having called it sensationalism. The FBI memo, mentioned before, also took its shot, since under the banner, "Allegation Previously Branded False," it read, "It should be noted that the allegation concerning the Attorney General and Miss Monroe has been circulated in the past and has been branded as utterly false." To his credit, Capel, obviously not a man to be intimidated by government power, actually gave the Bureau advanced notice of the book being published, and the Bureau, in turn, had apparently advised Robert Kennedy of its existence even before the July 14, 1964 letter to him from Director Hoover. Certainly the paragraph reading, "According to Mr. Capel, his book will make reference to your alleged friendship with the late Marilyn Monroe. Mr. Capel stated he will indicate in his book that you and Miss Monroe were intimate and that you were in Miss Monroe's apartment at the time of her death." Based on wording such as Mr. Capel stated, he had met with FBI agents about the book, providing heads-up information about it directly to these agents. Without question, the FBI memo's content bashes Capel at every turn in an obvious attempt to discount his accusations regarding RFK's relationship with Marilyn and any potential that he had anything to do with her death. But just as Dorothy Kilgallen refused to name her sources, "I would rather die than do so," the memo includes, "Capel has consistently refused to reveal the alleged sources of his information." That statement is followed by yet another FBI memo, which contained the following opinion, apparently from an agent identified as Mr. F.J. Baumgartner. He stated that, "Some allegations of Capel are from public sources and are apparently true. Some are completely false, and others are extremely questionable and not subject to corroboration." What allegations were apparently true are not specified, but apparently Baumgartner found some credence to what Capel had written. In yet another memo, this one from SAC New York, meaning Special Agent in Charge, that agent wrote, "It was noted that Capel appeared very emotional and aggressive when he advised of this book and was unable to state the exact purpose for writing it," another attempt to discredit the author. While this author has not been able to discover whether the FBI followed up on the allegations against the Attorney General or whether he took any action, doubtful either happened, no media exposure discovered, there must have been some concern about Capel's revelations, true or false. Under the same banner as above, SAC New York, the memo read, "You are instructed to follow this matter very closely, while requiring the New York office to apparently purchase books in order that the Attorney General may be kept advised." Did purchase books mean that Joe DiCarlo's statement that there are not too many copies around The Kennedys had tried to keep it off the market to the extent of even buying as many copies as possible, relate to the Kennedys purchasing copies as well as those in the New York FBI office doing so, thus, in effect, confiscating as many books as possible so the public could not read them? And why did the memo state that the FBI purchasing copies was necessary in order that the Attorney General may be kept advised, since the Bureau already had copies of the book, leading to the question, what was the Attorney General going to be advised about? Common sense seems to indicate that the Kennedys, but especially Bobby, were quite concerned about Capel's book, more concerned than seems necessary for a book that they knew was being denounced at every turn as pure garbage in the memos. However, the apparent need by the Kennedys to get the book off the market by purchasing as many copies as possible triggers the belief that Bobby knew one thing for sure. What Capel had written was absolutely true. Joanne Romanovich could certainly understand what she called her uncle's hatred of Bobby Kennedy, telling this author that Joe DiCarlo had, at one point, met RFK at the Capitol Building in Washington, D.C. Joe hated Bobby for Joe Kennedy's double cross of certain mafia in 1960 after they helped JFK win the presidency, she told this author. Romanovich also said DiCarlo told her, I know who did it, meaning who killed JFK, without providing any name or proof. Further evidence of DiCarlo's interest in and knowledge of Marilyn's death emerges from Romanovich's discovery of a copy of the Los Angeles Times obituary for former Los Angeles County Deputy District Attorney John Minor, an obituary Mickey Cohen's enforcer saved within the pages of Capel's book. Minor, one of the investigators assigned to Marilyn's death and also present at her post-mortem examination, according to the obit, had made headlines in recent years when he revealed the contents of private audio tapes the actress recorded for her psychiatrist, Ralph Greenson, before her death. The obit went on to state that Minor believed the recordings helped prove Monroe was not suicidal. Assessing Minor's credibility is the true double-edged sword, but even a balanced view leads to skepticism regarding two matters of great importance regarding both Marilyn's life and times and her death. These deal with whether Marilyn, shortly before she died, recorded on audio tape what Minor called free association thoughts about her mindset at the time and Minor's version of how she died. The audio tape issue certainly muddies the water. In a December 2005 Playboy article, this author discovered, widely heralded as including never-before-reported info about the strange, still mysterious death of Marilyn Monroe, Minor swore that Marilyn did indeed record the tapes and then gave them to Dr. Ralph Greenson, her psychiatrist. Within days of Marilyn dying, Minor wrote that while Greenson would not give him copies, the shrink let Minor listen to them. He then, according to the account, hurried back to his home and made notes about what Marilyn had recorded. The major hole in Minor's story speaks to the continual distortions of history about the movie star, the sensationalism prohibiting an accurate portrayal of her life leading up to August 4, 1962. The account Minor provided in Playboy under the banner Marilyn Uncensored runs for several pages, beginning on page 79 and running several thousand words in length, filled with details, all told in Marilyn's voice. That Minor was only permitted to make notes when Greenson let him listen to the recordings, and yet could recall that much of what he called an accurate depiction of what she said, borders on the preposterous. Playboy apparently bought the story in yet another example of shoddy journalism, contributing to depriving Marilyn of a true account of her life and times as she neared the date of her death. Another aspect of Minor's alleged accurate words he puts in Marilyn's mouth that appears to bear false witness concerns the salacious tilt given to very private thoughts about her sex life that go far beyond any sense of decency and therefore any chance of believability. Also, one must consider that Minor did not reveal the recordings and their substance for more than 40 years after she died and 26 years after Greenson passed away. Of interest is, at the time the Playboy article appeared, Minor told the Los Angeles Times, "Here is a person, Monroe, stigmatized by the diagnosis of suicide when that is an absolutely wrong, false, erroneous diagnosis." The lack of credibility regarding what Minor exposed about Marilyn in the article discounts the credibility of that statement, but two factors provide some credibility for what he told the Times. First, Dr. Cyril Wecht, the revered forensic scientist previously quoted who had first met Minor in 1963, told the Times, "John Minor was an outstanding attorney. He had a keen legal mind. He had a sharp intellect, and he had the desire and the willingness to learn as much as he could about various forensic scientific specialties." And second, for whatever reason, Joe DiCarlo saved Minor's obituary tucked inside his copy of Frank Capel's book. He never told his niece, Joanne Romanovich, the reason why. Regardless, Minor's account, even if it is partly true, portends of another side of Greenson's character. A disturbing side, since he had violated Marilyn's trust in him by permitting the assistant DA access to audiotaped interviews she believed only Greenson would hear. Thus, Greenson's professional ethics must be questioned, since in effect, he had betrayed Marilyn.